Hello. Question for you. How many of you have used the internet today? Well, that's a pretty good number. There's a couple people did raise their hands, and I'm curious your tactics. How many of you have used the internet in the last 60 seconds? Wow, okay. All right, so this is a pretty commonly used thing, probably worth talking about. Before we do that, any questions? Okay, great. So recall last time we were discussing exactly that, how the internet is actually able to accomplish its myriad of goals. One challenge we have is that the network itself is not perfectly reliable. It's a best effort service. And so when machine A tries to send a message to machine B, it might get there. Likely it will, but it's not guaranteed. So our first tool to deal with that was this idea of acknowledgments. So we expect that machine B will send back a response, a got it message, letting machine A know that, yeah, the message was successfully received. Now, it's possible that that process doesn't occur as we expect, that the message is lost, or the acknowledgement is lost. In that case, A won't get the got it message. And so presumably it still wants to accomplish whatever networking task, and so our second tool was this concept of a timeout, where A will wait for a period of time. If the acknowledgement isn't received, then it will have to just retry. And this idea that it's better just to resend rather than try to play additional games is actually what real networks do. Any questions about this? This sort of what we were talking about last time. All right. So having a message lost is not the only issue that can happen. We can also have a message that gets delayed. So it actually is received eventually, but because of something that happened in the network or a particular path it took as it went router to router to router, it took longer than expected. And so if the original message is delayed, it might look something like this. It's still sent, it's received by B as expected. However, right, it just took a little bit longer. And then B, as it's supposed to, sent back the acknowledgement. But what's going to happen in this case? Yeah. That's right. A doesn't know. A doesn't know that this message was delayed, or if it was lost, or if the acknowledgement from B was lost. So all it sees is the timeout. And so A is going to have to then resend that same message. That will hopefully get to B, and B can respond with another acknowledgement, which can hopefully get back to A. And so now we still have the successful communication, although this looks a little bit different, right? Because we've sent the same message twice. From A's point of view, it got two acknowledgments for the same transmission. But these are the real world issues that we just have to deal with. And so B here doesn't know that it doesn't need to retransmit the acknowledgement because the message came through, because the B doesn't know if the original acknowledgement was lost or not. Like, it doesn't know why A decided to retransmit this. It also doesn't know when A started. Right? It doesn't know that the first message had this extra delay. So all B can do is just acknowledge both receipts. Just like we said with messages, right? If messages can be lost, acknowledgments can be lost. Well, if a message can be delayed, so can an acknowledgment. So maybe the original message sort of goes as we expect, but then the acknowledgment is delayed. From A's point of view, this is the same, because it doesn't know which thing happened. It just sees the same case, which is that there's a timeout to ensure reliable communications. It's going to have to resend. B has to acknowledge. And we end up with kind of the similar situation. B gets the message twice. It acknowledges twice. A gets these additional, or sort of this extra acknowledgement after sending that, after the timeout and then the sending it again. Okay, so little bit of strange behavior, but nothing quote unquote wrong so far. Does anyone see a potential issue here? Yeah. Ah, okay. So what happens if this timeout keeps occurring? So it times out, it transmits again. If these acknowledgments are lost, and it times out again, and then transmits again, and so on and so forth, right? And so that's probably a symptom of a pretty poor network, right? Something is going wrong. A can keep trying, or it might give up when it detects that it's just trying too many times. It's like, yeah, sorry, something's broken. We sometimes see this, right? We'll see like an error message in a browser of like, yeah, the connection couldn't happen for some reason. Yeah?
Is it possible to get an acknowledgement for the wrong message that was sent? Like if an acknowledgement is delayed and it's like sent and the machine A thinks it's for a different message?
Interesting. Okay, let's see. Okay, so what could happen here? And let's go back to this. Yeah, where did we, it was best to, trying to think where, okay, yeah. Right, so let's take this, so we have a delayed acknowledgement. Okay, so what could happen? Well, what if we retransmit here? Okay, that's fine. Let's say that gets through. Okay. What happens when we get this acknowledgement? What does A think? Yeah. Exactly. Right? He's like, great. I got an acknowledgement. B received my message. Wonderful. So if we have a meeting and it's at a particular time, what else do we need to know? Where it is, right? Is it on Zoom? Is it in a particular room? So what's A likely going to do? A is likely needs to send the next thing, you know, with some room info. And so that will go on. Okay, no problem. What does B do when it receives that retry? Acknowledges, right? So B sends back an acknowledgement. So what does A think? Great. My previous message must have gone through. Now what if, you know, that message didn't actually go through? So what's happened here? We retransmitted the original message about it meeting at noon. The ACK was delayed. A interpreted the ACK as though that retransmission was successful. So it went on and sent the next thing, which is like the room. That message, however, was not successful, but B acknowledged the duplicate. By the time that acknowledgement arrived at A, A was like, perfect. And so what happens when A shows up at the correct room at noon? No one's there, right? Because the message was not actually received correctly. So this is definitely an issue. What else? Is there another thing that seems like it could be a little wrong here? When these messages get delayed and we have retransmissions? Yeah. Yeah, could we get stuck in a loop, right? So if the network is really, if the performance is very bad, the timeout is maybe too short, right? We'll just keep having the timeout and retransmit. Hopefully A will give up at some point. Yeah. Well, we have seen the wrong order for the acknowledgments in the sense that the acknowledgement is kind of paired with the wrong transmission. In this example, there is some confusion there. We're kind of only sending one thing at a time. But from B's perspective, it's receiving these valid messages here and here. They're the same. But B doesn't know what that means. Maybe A just really wanted B to know about this meeting at noon and sent it twice. Or maybe the second one was just a retransmission and the actual program only intended to send it once. And so B can be confused by this. We'll address that issue in a second, but let's look at a related challenge, which is the size limit in networks. So to make the hardware effective for building the routers in a network, we put caps on the total size of a message. So if a program wants to send something really, really large, it can, but just not in a single message or a single packet. It's gonna have to break it up into multiple smaller chunks. So for our example here, we're going to assume we have a very small size limit. And so we're going to send the same message. The meeting is at noon, but now we have to send it in two separate packets. In this case, where things look good, right, what B receives is what we expect. Okay, great. The common case works. What happens if the acknowledgement, however, is lost, the first acknowledgement? So the B still receives the first message, which is good. What happens at A? Right. A does not receive the acknowledgement, so we have a timeout. After a timeout, what does A do? It retransmits, as expected. B receives that as well, and so sends back the acknowledgement. But from B's point of view, it's got two valid messages, the meeting and the meeting, right? Once this acknowledgement is finally received, that allows A to then send the next thing, which is the time, and the acknowledgement then works. But what does B now receive? Exactly, right? B hears the meeting is at noon. Maybe that was intentional, maybe not. How does B know? Yeah. Yeah. In this example, we're assuming that A is going one message at a time. We'll talk about generalizing that in a little bit. But for now, basically, until A receives an acknowledgement for its first message, it's not going to go on to the second one. So this is a problem for B, right? If, because how does B know that it was a duplicate from the network and not something intentional by the program? Any thoughts on what we might do about this? Yeah. Okay, good idea. So what if instead of just sending the message, aka the meeting, let's include a number with that, right? An identifier. Something that's part of the protocol and not the actual message itself. And now we sort of have a way to identify one part of the message from a different part. And so that's gonna look something like this, right? Now when we send this, we send not just the message, but also this identifier. And when we send the next one, we send a new identifier. So we have part one and part two. So this general idea is what we call a sequence number. So this is our third technique for reliability. We had acknowledgments, we have timeouts. Third idea is a sequence number, which is a way to keep track of which part of this overall stream of data is this message actually represent. Good thought. So what does this allow us to do right now? So if we add this, now, if we go back to our previous example, the first acknowledgement's lost, so A retransmits. But now B knows that A isn't trying to just send the meeting. A is just trying to send the meeting because the part number is the same, the sequence number is the same. And so B can just be like, okay, I got a duplicate. That's fine. I need to acknowledge it because I don't know why A sent me that. Maybe my ACK was delayed. Maybe my ACK was lost. But for whatever reason, A did, so I'm going to acknowledge it. That acknowledgement gets to A, and now A can move on. And so we have addressed the initial problem. But there's still kind of this lingering question of, if we need to identify messages with these sequence numbers, do we also need to identify acknowledgments? Or is just a got it enough? Yeah. Exactly, right? So the intuition is saying, like, it really seems like we need to know what's being acknowledged, not just that something was received. And that's exactly right. And so if the first acknowledgement was delayed, well, A could interpret that as acknowledgement for part one, which is fine. It goes on and sends part two, as it should. But now the acknowledgement from the second, the retransmission, is received afterwards. And what does A think? Okay, A thinks that both parts got through, right? So we have that same issue from before. So even though B can differentiate, A is still not sure what the acknowledgement means. And so even though, again, B doesn't know the time, A thinks it does. And so we do have to amend this and actually include the sequence number of the acknowledgement as well so that A can differentiate what this acknowledgement actually means. And so we can do that by saying, instead of just A got it, well, what did we actually get? We got part one, we got part one again, and at the end, we finally get part two. What questions do you have? All right, so how do we make reliable networks so far? We need acknowledgments. We need timeouts. And we need sequence numbers. Okay, quick question for you on sequence numbers. How many sequence numbers do we need? Yeah. As many parts as you send. Is that send like total? So like if we wanted to send 10 messages total, do we need 10 sequence numbers? Okay. Yeah. Yeah, so there's kind of two ways of looking at this. One is we just need enough sequence numbers for the messages that we want to send, that we could send. But eventually we'll roll over, right? Probably. Is that a problem? Well, it's only a problem depending on how many possible messages are sort of in flight at once. And so in this example, because we're only sending one thing, and then we wait for the acknowledgement before we go on to the next thing, we really just need to differentiate. Is this the first thing or the second thing? Once we know we got part two, now we can go back and reuse the first sequence number. And so in this example, we just need two sequence numbers, or one bit. Now, if we were allowed to have multiple things sort of in flight at once, we would need more sequence numbers. All right, so we have one more issue to talk about, which is, okay, so messages can get lost, they can get delayed, they can also be successfully delivered, but not intact. Right, so the message can be corrupted in somewhere along the way. Now, when we say corrupted, we generally are thinking that one or maybe more than one bits have flipped. So a one became a zero became a one, somewhere in the packet. Now, imagine, so this message is going like hop by hop. If you've played that game Telephone, right? It's kind of, you know, that type of intuition, right? We expect that it will be the same every hop, but there's a chance that somewhere in there, a router decoded the message just slightly wrong. A zero became a one or something like that. Now, when it gets to the end, you've got a packet that isn't what the transmitter tried to send. You know, this original sender sends something else. The receiver has no idea. The receiver just gets data. But as a programmer, you could imagine if you're trying to write a network program and then suddenly the data are different when you get it on the server side or the other side, you're gonna be like, what is going on? So we would like to avoid this problem. How can we do that? So the technique here we use is called a checksum. And the idea is that whatever our message is that we want to send, and this is what we're trying to avoid. So if we want to send I like cats, if we get the very specific bit flip, well, your message is going to have a very different semantic meaning. And so to avoid this, we're going to send not only the message, but also the checksum. And so in this example, if we have some function which calculates the checksum, and that, let's say, is OXD9, we send the same original data, we just append that checksum to the end, or something like that. We somehow include it in some known location in the message we actually send. Now, why is this useful? Well, it's useful because the receiver can reverse the same process. It takes the data it receives, runs the same algorithm, checks the answer it computes with the answer that was transmitted in the packet. If they match, great. Network did a good job. If they don't, then we just treat the message like it wasn't received. And so what typically we call that, we drop the message. And just pretend like it didn't happen. We won't send an acknowledgement. Because we don't really know what went wrong. We just know something went wrong. Questions? So we can have different types of checksum algorithms. Like a simple one is just, we just add the bytes together and then take the lower eight bits and send that. We could count the number of zeros. There's different ways of computing a checksum. Now there's definitely an overhead here, right? So we have the overhead of doing the actual computation, but also now we have to send more data, right? We're sending an extra byte that isn't actually part of the application data, but it's probably worth it, right? Because sending one extra byte is probably cheaper than the confusion that could happen if we try to interpret a packet that's actually not valid. Okay, so that's our techniques. So we've got acknowledgments, timeouts, sequence numbers, and checksums. And those are the building blocks for networks to make a reliable connection between two machines on top of a network that doesn't guarantee correct, timely message delivery. Any questions? All right, cool. Good. So far, we've looked at a simple example. Not quite how things work in practice in terms of performance. Because having to wait for the message to be sent, go all the way to the recipient, and then get all the way back a response before we do the next thing is terribly slow. Now, in practice, the reason the internet is actually useful is that generally speaking, it works. Right? Generally speaking, the messages are delivered correctly. And so to take advantage of that, what we actually do in practice is something more like this. We have a window, and we're willing to send multiple messages at once before we've heard about the previous acknowledgement speculatively. And we assume it will get through, and then the machine can still acknowledge them, right? And so based on what we've seen, we would have, you know, act one, act two, act three, and act four here. But in terms of time, this makes a huge difference, right? Because if we measure the time for A to know that one message got through, right, we can look at when that started to when it actually confirmed with the acknowledgement. And then if we compare that to the time it took for A to learn that all four went through, right, it's only a little bit more. But if you think about it in the examples we've seen so far, A would have to pay this original time and then wait and then do that again, right? And so that would be down here. And then for the third one, again and again, and that's going to take much longer. And so things are going to load much slower. And so in practice, we actually are willing to speculate. Now, the challenge is how much? How many things do we send at once? Is it four? Is it five? Well, if four is good, is five better? If five is good, is six better? And so on and so forth, right? Like, if this increases performance, why not keep going? Well, if one of us did that, it would probably be okay. But if all of us do it, and we're all using this shared network, eventually we would overwhelm the network. We would all be trying to send as much data as fast as possible. That would exceed the capacity of the underlying network, and then things start to fail. And that's where we really would see a lot of packet loss. What did we say happens when we send something and we don't get the acknowledgement because it was lost? What do? We send it again. So we've overwhelmed the network, and then we respond by sending the data again. And so real protocols have to deal with this, and they try to adapt that window. They try to say, okay, I want to be strategically large so I get performance from my user without being too large that the network kind of gets overwhelmed and then nobody has a good connection. All right, these protocols that operate sort of dealing with the reliability operate at the transport layer. TCP is the main protocol that we use in practice that provides the reliable connection. An alternative that's widely supported is called UDP. UDP does not provide the reliable connection. So TCP is designed for a streaming interface. We can send data, and it's as though there's this continuous stream between the two machines. UDP is very message-based. I'm going to send this one discrete message, and that's it. There's no acknowledgments, there's no built-in acknowledgments, just I'm going to send a message. TCP is what adds this idea of having a window and streams and retries and sequence numbers and all of that. And so generally speaking, most of our network services are going to use TCP because they want the reliable connection. If you use UDP, we either are not so worried about reliability, which in certain cases is fine, or you want to just use it as a substrate that you're going to build your own protocol on top of. So the difference between the messages and the stream, so if we send something in UDP, it's discrete messages. Okay. Any questions about reliable transport, TCP? Anything? Let's go back to our layers. So we've been looking a lot at the transport layer, specifically this issue of reliability. To make a functional network, we also need to think about these other layers. One specific issue that comes up with splitting this into layers and enabling this global connectivity is how does the network actually know what we want to do? How do we support these different use cases? So far we've been saying machine A is going to talk to machine B. Well, who decided that machine B is called machine B? If I send something to B, how does the network know where B is? Like, I can't take an envelope and just write the letter B on it and put it in the mail. Post office is good, but they're not going to know what just the letter B means. That's why we have an address and a zip code. Similarly, we don't just want machine A as a device to talk to machine B. What we really want is we want a program running on machine A to talk to a program running on machine B. So, example of our web browser talking to a web server. The machine B might be running multiple things. So, for example, SSH, it's also running an SSH server. You know, our devices, we run many programs, many apps, all of which want to communicate at the same time. And so we need a way to differentiate those. And similarly, when we send to the remote machine, how does the remote machine send something back to us? How do we know what A is? And so a major challenge for networks is naming, is having identifiers, names, and addresses to specify what it is we actually want, what things are trying to communicate. You can kind of think of the left-hand column as more of the human-friendly column, and the right-hand column as more of the machine-friendly column. For example, if we think about programming, when we write a program, we want a variable name, right? Because that has semantic, intuitive meaning to us. Your processor does not want that variable name, right? The processor wants to know what memory address is that at, because that's what it can actually execute on. And so we have the same type of contrast for networks. As humans, we want to be able to have something that's readable like this, but computers want numbers that they can actually use to identify machines. So we'll talk about these, but let's start here. Let's start with this section here. So these IP addresses. So these are all examples. These are the identifiers, the addresses that are going to be used across the entire sort of global internet. And so these numbers will allow us to actually send something across the internet to, say, machine B. So these exist at the network layer, and we'll talk about these protocols, IP. So the main protocol at the network layer is called the Internet Protocol, which is really an audacious name for a protocol, that something that's going to work across the entire internet. But it has to, because to have a common framework, we need to agree on a protocol that's used on every machine that's connected. And this is really what makes this global network possible. There's two main versions that are in use today, and they're actually used simultaneously. So version 4 and 6. The other numbers were various things along the way, but these are the versions that are actually used, 4 and 6. And most devices support both. Okay. So within this internet protocol, this is where we get the notion of an IP address, because it's the address that's used for the internet protocol at the network layer. There's two versions. This is the version 4. So IPv4 uses a 32-bit number for its addresses. Now, this is just a number like any other 32-bit number we've used in this class. However, we typically write it as you see here, where we basically take each byte and write it in a decimal and then put a dot between it. So this is the same number here, just in decimal form. We could write this in hex. We sort of want the convenience of hex, you know, where we can separate the bytes nicely. But since we don't often think and write in base 16, you know, again, maybe not in this class where we do, but in general, that's why we use the decimal format. It's a little bit more familiar. But it's all the same number. Now, to be useful, we have to actually assign these addresses to particular machines, and we typically do that in blocks. And so organizations or internet service providers will get blocks. So UVA, for example, has a sort of range of addresses where all of those addresses are used or could be used by machines within the UVA network. Same for something like Google, which is going to have multiple to operate all of their services, and so on and so forth. Like large organizations, internet service providers are going to have these IP address blocks. Any questions? So these are still used today, and we'll talk about why in a second. We also have another version, which is IPv6. In a lot of ways, they're similar. A few things have changed between the two protocols. One of the most significant changes is that V6 uses a much larger address. Yeah? How are IP addresses assigned? We will talk about that on the next slide. Okay. So IPv6, much larger addresses. And this provides much more flexibility. However, it does make writing them a little bit more complicated. So if you see something like this, that's an example of an IPv6 address. It is written in hex. Every two bytes are separated by a colon. And then if we have a long run of zeros, we don't have to write out like 00000000000. We can just use two colons, which just means that fill in the address with zeros here. But we can only use that once. So even if there's like two strings of zeros, you can only put double colon one time. Now, 128 bits is a lot. That is a lot of space. Yeah?
You only do the double colon thing once, so that all adds up to 128?
That's right. Okay. That's right. So that way, like, we don't need to know exactly how many, we don't have to specify how many zeros here, we just know that there's enough zeros to make it so that it's the correct total length. So with 128 bits, we have a lot of flexibility. If you have a at home and your home internet service provider supports IPv6, you have probably been given 2 to the 64 addresses to use for just your home. And so you would never run out. But we have a lot more flexibility in IPv6, and that's one of the key reasons why there's a need to switch to it. Okay, so we have these addresses. Couple questions. So one is, how do we use them? And two is, where do they come from? So if we look at kind of a snapshot of a network, and so this is sort of a general picture, but it sort of captures the idea of how addresses can be used in practice to accomplish connectivity between any two endpoints in the network. And so here we can imagine that we have some packet that's come into this router, and the router's job is to decide which network should that packet go to next to get it closer to its ultimate destination. To do this, routers, generally speaking, have sort of a table of routes. And so this specifies what should happen. So if the destination is within, say, this block of addresses, so if where this packet is going is somewhere here, then it can look that up and say, oh, okay, I know what to do. I'll send that to network one. And so this packet will sort of traverse this path. Now, at the other end here, there's another router with an address, and so that packet will go to the next router, and then that router will have a similar decision to make. Okay, how do I get this closer? A packet with a different destination, say in this range, right, will be routed to a different next network. So that one will come in and go over here. And so because these networks are like physical networks with physical devices with wires running between them, there's a spatial component to this. And so what we are doing is we're not only are we trying to get it closer to the machine sort of in concept, but physically it needs to get to a particular geographic location. And so these IP addresses are tied, generally speaking, to geographic areas. So that clusters of IP addresses, these ranges that we're seeing here, we want those to be physically located. So as we get from router to router, we're actually getting the packet closer to its destination. If we didn't have that geographic clustering, then the rules would have to be, we'd have to have many, many, many more rules. We couldn't just have these like ranges. We'd have to say specifically, okay, this address goes this way, and this other address goes that way. And the state and the overhead of trying to do that at global scale would be immense. And so we have these clusters. And so similarly, we think about how do we get IP addresses? Well, we assign them, roughly speaking, in kind of a geographic way. So addresses that have a similar starting are generally going to be located in more of a similar area. So we sort of started with the whole address space, then we divided it up into continents, and then those continents have since subdivided to different countries and different organizations and different service providers to sort of allocate in a strategic way, so that makes this routing a little bit easier. All right, any questions on routing and address assignment? We'll talk about DNS in a little bit, and if you still have the question, please remind me. Okay, so that's two of the key functions of the network layer, assigning addresses and then being able to route messages based on those addresses. Another issue we have is actually back up at the transport layer. So we talked about this, but we didn't talk about the correct program. Because again, we don't want machines to just talk to machines, we really want programs to talk to programs. And so just having a single identifier, an IP address for a machine, is not enough. need a way to also tell the difference between a web browser and the TikTok app and a calendar app and your email app. And so that messages get to the right actual running program. To do this, we use a concept called a port number. And so this is a 16-bit number. It's actually at the transport layer. It's kind of akin to like a P.O. box or a specific person at an address. We can have multiple P.O. boxes at the same physical location. And this lets us differentiate which program a particular message is actually destined for. There's a few port numbers that are sort of well known. So SSH typically is run on port 22. HTTPS is typically run on port 443. It doesn't have to be, but for convenience and so that clients know what to expect, we typically run on these standard port numbers. Higher number ports are generally used sort of at random when our programs create a socket and we need to the operating system has to assign a port to it. It will sort of choose randomly from the larger numbers generally. Okay, so ports allow us to identify which specific connection and which program is using a particular connection. And so with ports and IP addresses in TCP, we now have a way to identify a full connection, so end-to-end. So we have the source IP address and the source local port, and then the remote IP address and the remote port. And with those four values, that sort of uniquely identifies a connection. And so the operating system knows where it needs to send the messages based on those four values. I also mentioned that the operating system will generally randomly assign a port number. If you do need a specific port number, that's what the bind call is for. So if you're running a web server, for example, and you want it to run on a particular known port number, then that's where we can use bind. Any questions on port numbers or this four-tuple connection? All right, cool. So back to our issue about names and the logical names and specific locations. So we talked a bit about these numbers, right? The particular port numbers and particular IP addresses. But as humans, I mean, we'd really rather not have to remember a lot of IP addresses. Like, you know, you could remember a couple. And actually probably, you know, if you went back like 20 years, it might even be better because we were used to remembering like phone numbers. So at least we kind of practiced remembering numbers. Now, it's like I feel like we have no chance. And so to avoid having to remember those numbers, we can assign them more readable names, like what we see here on the left. But the problem is that while we like the strings, the computers don't, routers don't, routers want the numbers. And so we need some way to do a lookup, taking the string and convert it to the number. But we also want to be able to do this for sort of any domain. The way we solve this is one of the most important tools that we have for computer networks, which is called DNS. So DNS, the domain name system, this is the tool that we use to take that human-readable string and convert it into a number, an IP address that we can use to actually route packets and communicate on the internet. The way this typically functions is we have our internet service provider will often provide a local DNS server that can do this lookup for us. So this is the tool that's going to be responsible for doing this lookup from the string that we have, our domain name, to the IP address. We learn about where this is, generally speaking, when we connect to the network. So So when we sort of join a network, we'll learn about the local DNS server option, whether it's from an ISP or like UVA operates them as well. When your machine wants to actually go to, say, a website like www.cs.virginia.edu, your machine doesn't know what IP address to use when creating the packet to actually send on the network. So it needs to ask the local DNS server for what that mapping is. Now, especially at sort of the beginning, your local DNS server doesn't know either. Because we don't want to just have this massive database stored everywhere that would be really hard to update and really hard to keep in sync. And so the local DNS server is going to have to go ask somebody. Well, if it doesn't know anything, where does it start? Who does it ask? Well, we start with what's called the root. So these are root DNS servers. These are at known IP addresses, because we sort of have a recursive problem. If we just wanted to go to like root.dns.org, well, where's that address? Okay, let's look it up. Well, that's what we're trying to do. So we have known addresses for root servers. And these are operated by like governments and large organizations and replicated across the globe. And we'll ask our question to the root. We'll say, hey, I'm looking for www.cs.virginia.edu, where is that? Well, the root server doesn't know either, because the root server doesn't want to maintain a list of every possible domain. But what it does know is where you can find more information. So it's like, oh, you want a .edu? Oh, I can help you with that part. You should go look at and ask the .edu name server. And so, okay, so that'll send back, and then our local DNS server will try the .edu. And ask the same question. Well, the .edu server is going to go, I don't know where www.cs.virginia is, but I do know where virginia.edu is. So I know this part. Why don't you go ask this DNS server? So you do that. You ask Virginia's DNS server for www.cs.virginia.edu, and they're going to say, yeah, I don't know what that is, but I know where the CS department keeps its DNS server. I know the IP address of that. So why don't you go ask there? So that will go back, and then, okay, let's try that one. Do you know what www.cs.virginia.edu is? And that DNS server is, of course, yeah, I know that. And so then it'll actually respond with the intended IP address, which then the local DNS server can provide back to your machine. And so what this allows us to do is to make essentially a very large database of all the mappings from all the domain names that exist to the IP address of the server that's running or is associated with that domain, distribute it among an entire tree, a hierarchy of different servers, which gives us sort of nice robustness properties, because if some of those DNS servers fail, we don't lose the ability to do any DNS lookups. And it also means that the organizational structure is much simpler. So if the CS department wants to change where it hosts something on its, change where it hosts its website, let's say, well, it just needs to update a local record. It doesn't need to go and talk to some other authority to make that change. Questions about DNS lookup? Aha, yes, so that's a great insight. So the first time when we know nothing, we have to go through this whole process, back and forth, going through the layers of the tree. But we learn a lot of information while we do that. And so this local DNS server, part of its job is to cache that information. So if someone else comes along So say there's two of us in this room that both want to access www.cs.virginia.edu. The first one, we have to go do this whole lookup. But the second person to ask that same local DNS server, the DNS server's like, oh, I know that already. I cached it from earlier. And so we can speed up the response. And we can also save like where the .edu server is. So if we ask for, I'd say, a different university's website, well, we don't need to go back to the root and ask again. We can just go right to the .edu layer. And so that's one of the benefits of having this local server to do this on behalf is that we get this aggregated cached data from a variety of, from all the requests that are happening in the network. Yeah?
So I was wondering, is this kind of like the same mechanism as like telemetry tables where like each one is like, so it's like sparse
I mean, it's a similar concept, right? We divide things into multiple lookups. So we can keep certain information. I think the goals are a little bit different, but I think you're right. There's a certain similar flavor there. Now, whenever we cache data, right, it could be out of date, and so that server will also just have to forget after a certain amount of time and then do the lookup just in case it's changed. So I think there's a question from earlier about like, okay, if we're running DNS, how does this interplay with the other layers that we've seen? And so in practice, DNS uses UDP. So it's actually an application layer protocol running on top of UDP, and then that runs on top of the IP layer that actually can send these messages to all these remote servers. And so even though this is a core piece of functionality, it's actually implemented like any other network application. It's just sort of a special application, but it uses the same layering principles we've been talking about. All right, any other questions on DNS? Can local machines cache these DNS lookups? Sure. Right? I mean, they're going to, they see what they asked for. They see the response. They can absolutely cache that. You can actually do this whole lookup from your local machine if you want. I mean, there's nothing privileged about the DNS server. We just use that, again, for convenience, for historical reasons, for the ability to cache from other people's requests, not just our own. But in practice, to avoid the downsides to caching, which is like, what if things change? You know, we do the requests and just use the local server, but we could. Okay, so those are domains. So this part right here is a domain, right? Specifies sort of a ownership and management structure, as well as like a way for a human-readable identifier for a particular machine. We see these domains all the time. We usually see them in the context of a URL. So a URL takes the domain but adds additional flexibility so that we can actually not just talk about machines but resources on those machines. So we've seen examples of this. This there's a bunch listed here. In this top one, this is our domain. We're also specifying explicitly our port here. We don't have to do this, but we can. And then after that, we have an actual path for where the resource is. We can have additional arguments, and then we can have a marker where on the page we want to go to. And then at the beginning here, we actually have our protocol, our scheme that we're using when accessing this. And so HTTPS typically runs on 443, so those we would expect to match. But this is kind of the expanded version of sort of the way that we access a lot of resources on the internet. Now, sometimes we sort of see these, right? If we are in a browser and there's, you know, the address bar is showing it to us, Other times these URLs are used inside. So like with smartphone apps, the programmer probably used a lot of these URLs, but they're not really exposed to us as users. We can do this for HTTP, but also for different protocols like FTP, or telephone, or something that's just sort of known based on the context. But this idea of kind of this folder path-like structure is very useful. Now, one of the main use cases is this HTTP. So this just kind of summarizes that. But HTTP is one of the most common application layer protocols. It really underpins the web. And so when we go to a particular web page in a browser, the browser is using an HTTP request on our behalf. Similarly, a lot of times, whatever app we're using, even though we're not seeing that address behind the scenes, it's probably also making a lot of HTTP requests. The traditional version runs on port 80 and the secure version on port 443, typically built on top of TCP because we want that reliable communication. We want the web page to look the way that the server, the original creator of that web page intended it to be. We use URLs, and then to actually request data, we're using HTTP commands. There's more than these three, but these are the three most common. So when we load a web page, what's happening behind the scenes is the browser is doing a GET request to the remote server for that particular URL. Now the server hopefully responds if it's a valid request that it understands and you're allowed to access. And HTTP is what's called a client-server protocol. So our browser is the client, it's asking the remote machine, the server, for a resource, and the server responds. When the server does that response, it also includes what's called a status code to sort of give some indication of, well, how did it go? What we want to see is 200. That means, okay, everything was fine. Some other common status codes are 404, which means whatever you were asking for, I couldn't find. So it's basically, it's like maybe you are looking in the wrong place, or maybe it's gone now. So that's where the number 404 comes from. If something else more severe went wrong, we have 500, like a server error, like something is broken here. And so we do the request, we get the response back. And then to do the next thing, our browser makes another HTTP request and gets another response. And we keep going like that to load a web page, to load a new web page, to load the JavaScript, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so it's just sort of a brief introduction to HTTP. Again, you can, if you go into your browser and look at the developer tools and the network tools, you can see all of the requests that your browser is making. Any questions on HTTP? All right. So one thing that we kind of alluded to earlier was that at the network layer, we have these IP addresses, and we have two versions, IPv4 and IPv6. One of the major drivers for IPv6 was this recognition that we were going to run out of IPv4 addresses. Now, IPv6 is not new. It's decades old at this point. Like, people could see the writing on the wall. IPv4 with 32 bits, yeah, that was reasonable at one time, but now that's not even enough per user, much less per device. So it motivated the switch to IPv6. However, the IP layer is the layer that every internet device has to agree upon, because all the routers need to understand that protocol so that they can communicate and forward packets correctly. All of our devices have to know this so they can send a valid or receive correctly. So every internet-connected device has to agree on these protocols. That makes the upgrade story very difficult. It's hard to to get everyone to agree, like, okay, on today, we're going to just all switch. So that's why we kind of run these in parallel. So when we ran out of addresses, and it sort of happened differently. Again, I said that addresses are divided up by continent. North America ran out first of sort of new addresses to allocate. That actually makes them kind of scarce and valuable, which is kind of interesting that you can actually buy a number. Last I checked, they were about $10 a piece in large quantities if you sort of buy them from somebody who's not using them. And so switching to IPv6 really removes this stress because we have so many more addresses. However, it's hard to switch. So to deal with this issue, which is that we've run out of addresses, and like if you bought a new device, like what address would it have? There's a tool called NAT. And NAT is kind of a neat trick, which lets us share one address for many devices. Now, this kind of violates what I've told you so far, which is IP addresses identify devices. So we're kind of blurring that a little bit and saying, well, this IP address is really going to identify a whole set of devices. So the idea here is that we're going to tell the rest of the internet that we have one public address. And as far as the rest of the internet is concerned, there's sort of one address that it's communicating with. But behind the scenes, we're going to have many local devices which all think that they have different addresses, but in reality, they're actually sharing a single one. Okay, so what does this look like? So if we have a whole series of devices attached to our network over here, as far as they're concerned, they have a unique IP address. That address, however, is only valid on that internal network. It's not routable on the public network. So these like 192.168 addresses that we often use, especially at home networks, those work fine at home, but you can't use those on the rest of the internet. So what happens? Well, when these devices operate thinking that that's its address, when it tries to send a message, it's going to do what it expects to do, which is use its source address, which is this 192.168 address, with whatever port was assigned to the particular application process that's running for a particular connection, and then send it to some remote address. And now this remote address is public. It does need to be globally routable. So that's what the device does, but the router says, okay, hold on. Before I actually send this, because I can't send it the way it is, it won't work, I'm going to change it. I'm actually going to swap out the source address, kind of behind your back, with an actual valid public address, aka the address of the router. And then I'm also going to change your source port. Generally speaking, the source port doesn't really matter for the actual application, so I'm just going to change that. It was probably randomly generated anyways. Now, of course, the destination stays the same because we want to go to the same place. So this is a really neat trick. From the device's point of view, it's not changing. It has no idea this is happening. But now we can actually use this one address for multiple devices on the real global internet. When that server, whatever this 1.2.3.4 is, responds, it's going to respond to this. Right? It's going to use that destination address and that as the destination port. Well, that service isn't actually running on the router, right? Remember, this came from our device over, I guess it's this one over here. But the router's like, well, wait a minute. I know what to do here. I'll just take the destination address, swap it out with 192.168.1.4, and I can tell which device this is for because I chose a particular port number. So if I see port number 54923, I know that that means device .1.4, and I'll swap it back to port number 39129. And all of this just happens behind your back. So it's kind of an interesting trick. It uses both the network layer and the transport layer because it uses port numbers and IP addresses. It's a little bit odd, right, that we're sending stuff and then in the middle, this router is just changing our data and not telling us about it. That's a little odd, but it does solve this problem. It's widely used, like every home network uses it. UVA uses it. So if you look at your IP address in your like operating system settings, it'll probably say like 172.16.something. And if you Google, what is my IP address, it will tell you a very different number. So UVA uses it. Again, home networks use it. So it's very, very common, even if it is a little bit strange. And so the NAT device will basically have a table like this so it can do the lookup. It will create an entry when you try to send something, and then it will use it to look up how to fix up the response so it gets to you in the way that your device expects. Yep. Correct. So this is the port number that the actual local device used, and this is the port number 54923 that the remote server saw. And again, because the protocols generally don't care what your source port number is, this won't change how the remote server behaves. Any other NAT questions? Yeah. Yes. Basically changes how we build this table. All right, so NAT's useful to understand because it is in practical terms, it's helpful to understand a local address that's only valid, say, within UVA versus what you could use to send something from your house. So a public versus local address makes a big difference in what we can do. Okay, so let's just kind of wrap things up here. The lab for next week is going to be on networking, and we'll be playing around with some of the ideas that we've seen. So specifically, we're going to be looking at a protocol and implementing reliable transfer here, where your responsibility is to sort of ask for to retry if things are failed, and implement a version of acknowledgments by asking for the next thing, which signals that you got the previous thing. The general protocol structure will look like this. We'll have, have a get command, which asks for a particular piece of data, and then you can acknowledge that you got part of that data, which will then trigger the next part of it. And so if you don't receive it, then you'll retry the retry to get it to send again. To do this, we're going to use a environment called callback-based programming. This is often used in kind of some networking use cases. So this is an example of the code that you don't write. So this is sort of the simulator which is making this work. It's basically a loop sitting here in this while loop. And what's happening here is basically it's checking to see if an event has occurred. If a particular event has occurred, then what it does is call a function. If a different event has occurred, call a different function. And so then, as programmers, what we see is basically we have to implement those functions. Now, if there's nothing happening, we don't really care. We only are interested in when some event actually happens. So if we say receive a message, then the receive function is called, and we can handle that. If a timeout occurs, well, then we'll get the timeout function will be called, and we can handle that as appropriate. And so we can still call send, but then most of the code will be written in these functions whenever events occur. And so this maps to certain programming styles, like sort of handling these events, waiting. User interfaces often look like this because you want to have an event when somebody clicks on something, or when they drag, or when they double click. And even web servers will sometimes do this to multiplex resources among many potential connections. So that's just a little quick brief primer on the lab for next week. We will resume on Tuesday talking about something we haven't gotten to yet, which is security. And can we do this safely and securely?